Okay, welcome everybody. So we're talking about eating in a non-kosher restaurant. So again, there's sort of two aspects to it. One question is, what can one eat in a non-kosher restaurant once considered what's kosher? And the second question is, what about if eating something kosher in a non-kosher restaurant, what are the issues involved? And again, the most obvious one is Maris Ayin, how it looks. So the Gemara says, and I apologize that not everything is translated to English. In this article, he translates a few of the sources in sort of short terms, and there's some other things that I cited, but there just aren't translations for a lot of these things, so we will kind of free translate them. But in general, tshuvot, you know, responsa, and even the Shulchan Aruch, beyond, you know, sort of the first part of Shulchan Aruch that's translated, really I don't think anybody's translated Yoredeya. So the Gemara says, there's a Mishnah, and the Mishnah says, one who, and you can see it's sort of in the English, he kind of free translates it, one who, whose garments fell into the water, it sounds like he's going on his way somewhere, he's like coming home, and he fell in the water, so he can, and Shabbos, this is from Gemara Shabbos, he can keep walking with them, he doesn't have to worry that it's considered wringing out his clothes or something like that. Assuming he's not, you're not allowed to wring out the clothes, but he can walk with them on him. Yil chatzer chitzona, when the person gets to the outside courtyard, so then they're allowed to put their clothing out in the sun. But they're not allowed to do it publicly. Right? Now, that's the way that houses were made. You had a house, you had a courtyard around it. So when you get to your courtyard, and some of these courtyards were semi-public, like they were shared with another house. Mm-hmm. So when you get to the outer courtyard, you could, since that's not a public place, you could put your clothes out to dry in the public place, but in the courtyard, but not in a public place. Why can't you put them in a public place? What's the issue?
Well, somebody who doesn't know the halacha could be misled and think that it's okay to do.
Think what's okay to do?
Think it's okay to launder clothes on Shabbat.
Exactly, right. Now, this person fell in the water, and now they're just laying their clothes out to dry. There's nothing really halakhically wrong with that. But a person who actually did laundry on Shabbos, wrung out their clothes, you know, washed them, that's biblically forbidden on many levels. So, Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rav, any time that the rabbis forbid something because of how it looks... Right, so here the Gemara, the Mishnah makes a distinction between a public place and a private place. In a private place, you could do it because people won't see it and assume maybe you did your laundry on Shabbos. In a public place, they might assume that. But Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav throws in sort of a new idea, and he says, you know, maybe you should be more strict than the Mishnah because the rabbis actually forbid everything that they forbid because of how it looks, they forbid even in private. Right, so. On the one hand, that's a little counterintuitive, because if it's in private, nobody's going to see it. Why should you make that forbidden? So it seems like, even though we don't usually make two fences around something, Gemara often asks, so you're not allowed to make two fences. Sometimes Gemara's answer is it's really one fence. But over here, there's a rabbinic, it's forbidden rabbinically to do something in public that'll look like you did something wrong. And even in private, because he might come to do it publicly. So is that two fences? Is that one fence? It seems that it was kind of made as a general. Often when the rabbis made decrees, they didn't put details in. They just kind of made them across the board. We had this with cheese. Right? Cheese, even though it's made kosher, cheese made by a non-Jew was a general decree, and it was kind of made across the board, maybe even for countries where they make cheese out of vegetarian rennet. That was the subject of argument. But the argument for that would be that when you make a rabbinic decree, you want to make it with no details, because once you start saying, you know, here the decree applies, here it doesn't, basically there is no decree there.
So as long as we're in the Chazara portion of the program, can I ask a question that's like reviewing? Because actually, I didn't so much think more because of the Rebbeim who were here, like about food and eating. I already do, but Pas Yisrael, I did notice that. So like, if for bread to be kosher in the first place, it can't be pasakum. So then I started thinking about why is it marked kosher if it's, are you suggesting that it's pasakum? I mean, like the whole thing just like, whoa.
Well, there's two issues about it.
For the first time ever, like I hadn't really consciously thought about it until this class, and because of the halal discussion, it started to like.
Well, so bread is a separate thing. I mean, obviously one question is, are the ingredients kosher? Assuming the ingredients are kosher, the question is, can you eat the bread made by a non-Jew? So there was a decree against making bread baked at home by a non-Jew, because you might come to marry them. But that decree was not made on sort of bakery bread, non-Jewish bakery bread.
So what's the big deal of, like, no, but, like, it still has to be cooked. Like, the whole explanation they give, like, on OU about how come it's called, you know, Pas Yisrael, is that a Jew has to be involved.
Exactly.
Like, even just igniting. Well, that's true for all kosher goods. I understood OU. Everything has
Kishalakum.
To be. Right, exactly. So
sure. That's true. Oh, why is bread different than anything else? It's not. It's only more lenient. If it's baked by kind of a company. So we learned that you're allowed to put your clothes on Shabbos in the sun to dry out, but not in front of people. And the Mishnah actually says that, or the Brisa says that, you can put it out in a private space. There you go. But not in a public space. Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Shimon said you can't even put it in a private space to dry out. So this question of, so it seems like on the one hand, the Mishnah seems to think you could do it in a private space, but not in a public space. Remember, you're not doing something wrong, you're doing something that looks like you might be doing something wrong. But there seems to be an argument, some seem to hold, that even b'chadrei chadarim, even in a private space, something that looks like you're doing something wrong would be forbidden. Okay.
Which is so interesting, because the whole point in the first place was based on appearance.
Right. So the whole thing is based for sure on appearance, on people thinking you're doing something wrong or thinking it's permitted to do. So the question is, how broad is that? Is that just where they might see it, or is that even where they won't see it?
So you don't get into the habit of doing it.
Right, basically.
Interesting.
Because, again, when you make a rabbinic decree, you don't want to have too many... conditions, or else, you know, because the whole point of it is as a fence. Once a fence has conditions, you sort of lose the fence property, perhaps.
Right, but it's interesting that the Mishnah, the I guess it's a Tanakhama.
Yeah, the Gemara seems to be more strict than the Mishnah, right?
Right, well, what the Gemara is saying is that there were Tanaim that disagreed.
Right, so they're quoting a Braita. Exactly.
Right.
So it's really a machloka, the Braita and the Mishnah, both of which are authoritative on the same level about whether this applies in a private place. Right, so we'll see how it sort of filters down through halacha. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, if your vessels or your clothes became wet on Shabbos, you can keep walking with them. You don't have to worry about that. You don't have to worry that you're squeezing them out just by walking. But you shouldn't lay them out because of Mar Zion, that people won't think that you're doing laundry on Shabbos. And even the Shulchan Aruch says, b'chadrei chadarim, even in a room within rooms, even in a private space, even in your house, you can't lay them out. Even though there's nobody there to see it, it's still forbidden. And they didn't just forbid laying it out, but even if you did it on Erev Shabbos, it was just on Shabbos, but if you laid them out on Erev Shabbos, that's not a problem. You can leave them there. You don't have to take them away on Shabbos. So the Mishnah Berurah writes, b'chadrei chadarim, within a private room, says that Tom, the reason is, d'lo chalku chachamim b'tekantan, that the rabbis didn't want to make conditions in their decree. Tosfot and the Rush write, dafku b'makam sheish chashash cheishdu haroim sheas isur diraita. So he says, Tosfos makes a distinction, though, between something that's forbidden from the Torah and something that's forbidden from the rabbis. That something that's forbidden from the Torah, like doing laundry on Shabbos, that was forbidden even in a private space. But something that's only rabbinically forbidden, let's say...
something that looks like laundry.
Well, no, something that's rabbinically forbidden, and then something that looks like you're doing something rabbinically forbidden.
So okay. You're saying the base
so that
prohibition.
You would be allowed to do, not in a public space, because people might think you're violating a rabbinic commandment, mm-hmm. or a rabbinic fence, but you could do that in private. So, for instance... it's forbidden. A lot of things forbidden rabbinically on Shabbos. Let's say, muktzah, right? So, using a hammer as a toy. You could use a hammer to crack nuts, but let's say handling money, right? Right. So that would be forbidden rabbinically. So, what would look like you're handling money, even though you're not?
Money's in the way, and you're just
fake
going
money.
In the muckle. Or fake money, but or also just moving money moving that's in the way, but it's not because you're touching the money for right, like as money be, right. per se. It's just in the way. So that's you're moving you have like a stack of money.
Yeah. Although
in the cycle. Right.
Under your bed.
Maybe it could be, yeah. Maybe.
I mean, aren't you allowed to do that already?
You are allowed to move right. mukta in a different different way. So that might be a little bit different. Let's say there are I'm trying to, I don't know why I'm blanking on.
Something that's not allowed, but you can do it in your house.
Something else rabbinically forbid. Oh, how about? Well, we'll run to. We'll run into it a little bit. We're going to run into it in a minute. Cooking chicken and milk. All right. So cooking meat and milk is forbidden from a biblical point of view, but cooking chicken and milk is probably only forbidden from a rabbinic point of view. So what about that? Would that be?
So if you do something that might make someone suspect that you're cooking chicken and milk. Though you're not actually doing it, you can do that in private.
Right, but not in public, right? What would be an example of that? Soy milk, for instance.
Oh, soy milk cheese, too.
Yeah, it's a lot of soy milk is actually dairy.
There are part of it,
right? You can get part of ones, yeah. Yeah, it's just that those are... if they say lactose-free, they can't, I don't think, have any milk, so they're probably made on dairy equipment. Right.
No, there's some. They have like a little bit of a thing.
Milk?
Yeah.
But if it was, but if there was milk, wouldn't they be like? I mean, they would be like a legal problem. Yeah.
Does the same apply to Pentecost?
That's a good question. So
it's
that's
not a
very
problem because that's the rise to a certain percentage before it gets considered like it's really there.
Maybe.
Which
maybe.
Is yeah. Crazy but true.
But that's true in Halacha also. So that's an interesting question. There's such a thing as a it's a fascinating case of ben pakua. Ben pakua means you slaughtered a cow, and out drops the baby. Right after you slaughter it. So what's the law of the baby? So the truth is the baby's considered slaughtered, even though it's walking around. So in theory, you could eat it. Probably you couldn't eat it alive. That would probably be considered, taking a limb from a living animal. But you could shoot it or cut off its head with a knife, let's say. You couldn't cause it pain. You're not allowed to cause animal pain. But let's say you had a painless way to kill it that wasn't shechita, cutting its head off. So you could do that and eat it. It's kosher. Why? Because it's already slaughtered, even though it's alive.
So it's like
it's an interesting halachic.
That's his hypo. He has the people there for dinner, and he does all these things where, like, apparently a non-Jew serves the wine, and apparently they're eating
really?
This. So there's like a three. So that's where you pulled that from.
Interesting.
And so there's three, and then everybody's like horrified. They're like, Sadiq, we gotta go. Sorry, you're awesome. We gotta bail. So then they leave, and then he asks them later what was wrong. But he was, like, trying to coax them into saying, well, we saw the rabbi do this, we saw the rabbi do that. He said, first of all, you should give me the benefit of the doubt. You know I'm not going to do these things. Second of all, I can explain them very easily. Bop, bop, bop.
Right. Well, that is important to realize.
But the problem that doesn't hit is the marat ayin. So I think the person who is offending should give the benefit of the doubt to the other person that they're not going to think bad things about them.
But there are situations.
Not the other way around.
Well, but there are situations in which people have halachic traditions. You know, that certain things are permitted.
Right.
Even though you might not, but you don't have to not do this because Marasayan, people have to know that there are, it's more, you know, it's not, there's not just the halacha of the art school book or whatever.
Right, but I think Yochev has raised an interesting point. There's a kind of tension between the assumptions behind Marasayan and the imperative of worrying about Marasayan on the one hand and the imperative of Damakav Schus on the other
hand.
That's
interesting, right.
There's inherent tension between those two principles.
So the Marat Ayin is definitely focused on the person who's Amaret. So you're looking out for the person who doesn't know Halacha or probably doesn't know Halacha. That's the way it's written on the Gemara, that you're like looking out for the person who has less knowledge than you do. But there is still the Damakav Schus because you are assuming that they're Amarets. If you're assuming that everybody around you is ignorant and doesn't know, then what you're doing might be your mitzvah.
If you see somebody laying out clothes, basically, what we're talking about basically is putting clothes on a clothesline, right? The person's putting wet clothes on a clothesline on Shabbos, and you see that, right? So the person doing it has a problem with Marat Ayin because you might be putting other people in the position that they would think either that's permitted. Or now maybe if they don you Lakav Schut, they might think, that must be permitted. He's such a tzaddik, right?
Right.
Or they might think, it's an interesting question, why is Marasayan Aser? Is it because of that, or is it because, or is it because they'll think that you are not, you're not allowed to make yourself look bad?
Right, and that's a bit of an important distinction. Is Marasayan, are we worried about Marasayan because somebody might infer from your behavior that something prohibited is in fact permitted?
Yeah.
Or are we worried about Mara Zion because of this, oh my God, what will the neighbors say thing?
Right. So both reasons are given in halacha.
Okay. I find the second reason to be very problematic because then you're basically giving in to people's telling lashon hara and not giving each other the benefit of the doubt.
Or right, you're protecting them by not putting a stumbling block before the blind because you're giving them a reason to do lashon hara if they have an inclination toward it.
Right. No, that's an interesting point. No, so why don't we demand that everybody judges each other favorably? Like
they do want
famous story of the famous story of the Berdichever, right? He sees there's all these stories about the Berdichever, right?
But why do you have to be judged?
Well, you don't have to be, but it's the nature of people that they do, I guess. I mean, why do you have to assume anybody would think anything?
To judge each other.
Why wouldn't you just assume?
Do you want to assume people will think? So that's a good point.
Assume the best out of people.
Right. So it's sort of, if you assume the very best, you may assume it's permitted. That's one possibility.
Right. So that's the other extreme.
If I see another Jew laying out his clothes, I'm going to think, oh, it's okay to do laundry. It must be because he's doing it. So that would be the very... No. Well, the other option is that the person...
They don't know enough to think that. Like, if it's really someone who doesn't know, then, like, they're not thinking like Shabbat. They can't do laundry on Shabbat.
Mm-hmm. So they might think it's... permitted.
They wouldn't even get to that point. They just don't care. What if they just don't care what you're doing?
Yeah, that would be nice if people were like that, huh? Yeah. Everybody was completely non-judgmental.
Right. Exactly. It's not the nature.
It's not the nature.
It's not absorbed.
It's not
people,
not human.
People care less about each other than we would like
I'm
to think.
Do what I'm
for the good
right,
and
right,
for the
bad. But in a Jewish community, it's ideal.
It's not the nature. We know that's not really the nature of human beings.
Because people copy each other and they infer. Right.
Maybe you're supposed to learn from others, right?
Right, that's how we can transmit
from how others
act.
You could learn from others.
If somebody I trust eats something, then I'm going to assume that thing is kosher. What I might not know is the whole story behind it, that maybe that particular thing. Like, you know, if someone's having a, I don't know, fake crab that actually looks like a crab, but I don't know that fake crab exists. If I see someone who I know keeps kosher having something that looks like a non-kosher animal, it's one or two things. Either I'm going to say that I guess they're not observant and maybe I can't trust their kosheris, or I'm going to say, oh, I trust them and I so maybe I can eat that, and I'm not going to realize that it's a fake.
But you're not going to say, oh, that looks really interesting, could you tell me what that is?
You're
assuming people are extremely mature and are good at communicating with each other.
That could also be somebody who doesn't know the person. Or,
right, and they might respond and say,
know,
that's none of your business.
And then the other person will come to shul, and they'll be like, oh, you can't count them in a minion. And they were, I don't know.
Well, the Baltimore kosher Subway would not allow fake cheese on their sandwiches.
Put the Cleveland one on the cheese.
I assume it's because of Mara Science, right?
So that creates...
It's the star case.
So what do you think that's based on, right? That creates a very interesting question, right? Why would one VOD say you could put fake cheese on the kosher Subway and another would say you can't?
I assume it's this.
But they both know there's such a thing as Mara Science.
Right. We're making assumptions about how people...
But what's the difference? What's the argument? What's the difference of opinion? Would you think it's an issue? Let me ask you that. Let's say that you were putting the supervision on the kosher Subway. What would you do? Would you allow them to
Why make it Subway? Why not make it, sub-place for half the price? Like, putting Subway on the name adds, like...
Well, they're all kosher Subways. Right?
I know, but, why did Baltimore not just make it, a sub... I don't know why they made it Subway.
I don't know the answer to... I don't know the answer to that, but... Probably people, maybe
people
the Jews in Baltimore are willing to pay for
go
it.
Into
yeah.
Be part of yeah, the
yeah.
When I was in Israel,
I would put an ad. I would just have them put a jingle ad thing on the front. You won't believe our cheese is parv or something.
That'll be a big seller.
If you label it soy cheese,
huh?
If you literally label it soy cheese and this is not dairy, when you're ordering, then I think it's very appropriate.
Well, so it's an interesting question. Do you have to? What sort of
non-dairy? Do they have dairy selections now?
No, it's soy, but the Baltimore they don't have
the meat.
It's either meat or it's parv.
Well, so the meat is meat at Subway. The question is, at the kosher Subway, can you put on parv cheese, or no cheese? In other words, would you allow par of cheese at the kosher Subway?
In an age of fake bacon, are we really even having this conversation?
So that's interesting. Well, so that's a good question. Is there a difference between fake cheese and right? So what's the question that it sort of hinges on, right? What's the analysis that these things would hinge on?
Right. Are we, again, it goes back.
Are you worried that somebody's going to watch you eat it?
Right. How worried do you have to be?
Are we worried?
In other words, and not just how worried do you have to be, but that's going to depend on what? It's going to depend on how common, right, par of cheese is, or how.
What in a community where, you know, there's going to be one Subway like that, everyone's going to know that whatever the equipment is.
In other words,
cheese.
If there is such a Subway and they use par of cheese, so everybody who sees
everyone
that.
Who knows that kid, the only
uh-huh. So that's an interesting question, right? It might be a question of, does Marseille have boundaries? Does it have city boundaries?
Right, if you have someone who visits the community. Again, we're talking about two different issues. Number one, we're talking, though they're related, we're talking about somebody making a false inference based on your behavior, on someone's behavior, that a certain thing that's prohibited is in fact permitted. That's concern number one. Concern number two is we're worried the person will say, oh, this person who's doing this is doing something that's forbidden.
Right.
It depends, like you said. How much benefit of the doubt? Do you give too much benefit of the doubt or too little benefit of the doubt?
And that might depend on what people do in the world, right? Now, for instance, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when par of ice cream first came out. So do you remember the first time, I don't know. I remember when I was young, I was like 10. You know, it was the first time I ever saw par of ice cream. Before that, there really wasn't par of ice cream. There was, you know, sherbet, which was made out of juice. But there just didn't exist, I don't think. You know, or I had never seen it. And the first time I saw it was like, it wasn't very good. But it was like, wow, we're having ice cream after me. Like, that's like a watershed. You know, that's really, who would have ever thought there could be such a thing? Right now, par of ice cream is much, it tastes like regular ice cream. But it's interesting, in those days, right, did you have to worry that somebody would come to your table and think, oh, either you're allowed to eat ice cream after me.
But anybody who tasted that stuff would realize it wasn't the same thing.
So what about today, right?
But when saw you walking around with it. But,
but today, though, at a Shabbos table, people serve par of ice cream. Mm-hmm. Do they tell anybody it's par?
Right, but at a Shabbos table, you can ask, and there's a certain thing.
You usually bring the container to the table. Yeah.
Oh, do you think you have to in order that people don't think it's regular ice cream?
I don't want to sit there and scoop everybody's ice cream.
I understand.
Or if you have an ice cream pie, where you're not ready.
Good. Right, let's say it's ice cream pie. You took that Trader Joe's ice cream and you put it in before Shabbos, made the pie thing. People do that.
People do.
So you serve that pie.
Really?
I do.
It's pretty good. You're very from.
only brings the container.
You don't want to do the word. Yeah. That's right. So that's a good question, right? Do you have to tell people this pie is par?
So that's what the Star K versus the other VODs were jumping on, was this idea of...
Well, that's what it sounds like.
If I was really worried, I'd keep the containers and I would save it for... I would say, oh my gosh, take a look.
Well, so that's the question. Does one have to be worried?
People get offended, though, because I was at a show in Miami with Rahim, and I was like, it's all kosher. I'm like, yeah, I know, but, you know, I kind of look. And it was like... Are you questioning? I was like, why?
So it's interesting. So take a look at page two. We'll see that this exact question actually was an issue 500 years ago. Yeah. There's a lot. You're living in the last millennium. Yeah, no, there's a lot. So the Shulchan Aruch writes that milk and meat is only forbidden to mix together if it's kosher type of animal, and if it's a domesticated animal with milk. But there are certain kinds of milk that it is permitted to cook with meat. For instance, according to Shulchan Aruch, the milk of a wild animal, or...
But how would you get the milk of a wild animal?
You'd have to get a deer and milk it. Yeah, I don't know. That I don't know. There are more rights that you're allowed to cook the, let's say, or the meat of a bird, right, with milk is forbidden rabbinically. So are you allowed to cook those together? You are. You're just not allowed to eat them together. So, but it's forbidden rabbinically to eat the milk of a, A bird that's cooked with milk.
Wait, when
together.
It says it's forbidden to eat together, they mean on the same plate, right? Because
cooked
clearly, because it's a cooked together, but you can eat it because the parties, that's like a big thing. It's not Shabbos to have both chicken and meat. That's like a
chicken and meat, but not chicken and milk. Right, we're talking about chicken and milk.
I thought you said meat.
No,
right?
Sorry,
now you
chicken
said
and milk.
Basar chayaveo.
With milk.
Okay.
Yeah, we're talking about milk. So, but dugim b'chagavim, fish and grasshoppers, those you're permitted to mix with milk, to boil with milk. No problem at all. Right? We do that. It's not all sfar to mix milk and fish.
Well, not the grasshoppers, really.
That's true. Right. We very few people probably show their grasshoppers.
I'm fascinated that they're just mentioning the grasshoppers as a matter of course, because I was under the impression that we don't have, not that I want to, but we don't have the kosher grasshoppers anymore, because despite the description in the Mishnah, we lost the tradition of what particular species of grasshopper.
Yeah, I'm not sure when we lost the tradition.
It's right.
Very few. Yemenites.
It's right. So I'm just curious, because the Shulchan Aruch, this is 500 years ago. I always assumed it was like lost 1300.
Yeah, well, so I'm not sure when it was lost. This is not a proof that it wasn't lost.
Okay.
Hagos, the Ramah writes, so Nagulasos Cholav Mishkedim. There's a custom, the Ramah. Now, the Ramah lives in 17th century Germany. And he says, or 18th century German, he says, there are people who make milk, believe it or not, out of almonds, almond milk. And they put into it basar oaf. They make chicken something with
chicken soup with milk.
There must be a chicken dish with milk, I don't know. A whole of the eno rachmit are abundant. He says, since it's only rabbinically forbidden to mix those together, and it's permitted to mix them together, but this is almond milk, so it's definitely permitted to mix almond milk and chicken together in terms of kashrut. People are going to think it's regular milk, and that's forbidden rabbinically. So remember our rule that rabbinic things that are forbidden are permitted in private, assuming that you're not violating. And it's things that look like a rabbinic violation are permitted in private, but not things that look like a biblical violation. So if you wanted to cook almond milk and meat together, that would be forbidden everywhere. If you wanted to cook almond milk and bird together, that would be forbidden in public, but in your home, that would in theory be permitted. So he says, what do you do if you want to cook almond milk with meat? So he says, so when you serve it, you got to put some almonds on the table. So here's my cow cacciatore, I don't know. But and there have to be almonds on the plate. And people will say, oh, that's almond milk. It's like putting the label out.
Yeah, putting the container.
It's exactly like the container. There was no container in those days.
So you couldn't do it with meat, with the almond milk?
No, so you can mix almond milk with meat or fish or birds.
You just have to do it in private. Okay. But it sounds like when you
serve it. But when you serve in your house, if you want
to
serve it.
A big sign indicator.
For meat. Right. But for oaf, you would not have to. Because the assumption would be that you don't have to, it's permitted.
They would never come back.
And you don't have to worry that they're going to think.
But if you're going to have almonds on the plate, it wouldn't matter if it was public or private.
Right. That would be, if you put almonds on the plate, so then it's not Marisayan anymore.
Right.
That's like putting out the label. Yeah. Right. You could.
It's like putting out the label. But how do we define public or private in this context?
Oh, you mean if you have guests over,
right.
Is that public or private? So since he said before your chatzer, it seemed to be geographic more than who's in the house. That's what it seemed to be from before, because he says your chatzer, your courtyard.
Okay.
Yeah, I think
but
so.
In this day and age when there are so many milk substitutes, and so we'll get back to the carve ice cream, thing, where back then it was an anomaly, so... it might be Marisayan, but now everyone knows there's tons of
right. So that's an interesting question. So does it change later in time? So take a look at. So I looked for a later tshuva, and if you look on the next page. This is from the Mishnah Halachos. And the Mishnah Halachos is writing in the mid-20th century. He's Hungarian, Rav Menashe Klein. He writes, says, Mikol Makom, Nira Lafina Stainti, says, it appears to me, he was asked about this question, he says, it appears to me to L'chadesh, to come up with a new idea. He says, I'm coming up with a new idea here. Right? He's living around the time when there's, you know, when I guess almond milk or soy milk or it's becoming more popular. He says, things are only marasayan if it's not the way of the world to do them in a permitted way. Al pi rov, most people. I guess he means most observant Jews. Odavar she'ena matzei kol kach b'derech heter, or something that really would says al b'davar shenago ha'olam la'asoto al pi rov. Says something that everybody does in a permitted way. Da'av she'esh mishum, even though it could be marasayin, it could look like you're doing something wrong. For instance, par of ice cream after meat lo chashinam le. We're not worried about that. D'chol ha'roa oto, because everybody who sees this person, Vada Yomer is going to say that they're doing it in a permitted way. Now, at what point, that becomes the big question, right? This is the cheese on the subway question. At what point can you assume, everybody knows that there's such a thing as par of ice cream. It's fine. In my house, if I serve par of ice cream, even if it's an ice cream pie, I don't tell anybody. But if I have somebody over that's like, you know, not observant at all, and this is like, you know, they haven't been to a lot of Shabbos meals, and I know they know that you don't eat milk and meat, you know. There's a lot of people who, like, would know that, you know, observant Jews don't eat milk after meat. But they don't know enough to know that, like, oh, that's par of ice cream. Everybody eats par of ice. Like, they might just think that it's regular ice cream, you know. And, like, maybe the rabbi's just not that observant, you know. And so if I have somebody over like that, I usually say, like, oh, this ice cream pie is made out of, you know, Trader Joe's par of ice cream or whatever it is. Because I know that, you know, I don't want somebody to assume either that it's not an important law or that it's permitted or that I'm doing something wrong. But in general, he says, if it's something people do, you don't have to worry about it. He says, cooking in almond milk, people don't usually cook meat in almond milk. Says, this is a big case in the Shulchan Aruch, right? The blood of a cow is forbidden to drink. But what about fish blood? Mm. So I don't know exactly how you get fish blood, but I guess it exists.
What do you mean?
Is it fish blood that looks like fish blood?
Yeah.
That looks like blood?
When you cut a fish open, it
looks like blood.
Really?
It's
very dramatic, okay. Yeah.
So fish blood, so let's say you put fish blood in a cup.
No, clearly
I'd say you have a cup of fish blood. I did used to go fishing when I was a kid. So,
cutting.
No, my brother did that. I grew up on the ocean. I was a little kid. Yeah. So you have a cup of fish blood, and you want to drink it.
Ugh.
Are you allowed to? That's the question. Right? In England, don't they make pie out of blood?
Yeah,
oh my
pudding.
God.
Pudding. Blood pudding.
Yeah.
Also, like,
very
Polish,
big about that.
Polish
oh my God.
Blood
gross.
Soup or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Okay.
So could you make it out? So can you drink, you know, can you have fish blood? Or do you have to worry about people saying? So in the Shulchan Aruch, it says that you have to make sure that if you're drinking fish blood, there's some scales, fins,
oof,
type
ew,
things
that's
in
nasty.
The sticking out of it, so I guess.
Idea with
kind of as garnish, I guess. Same idea. Right. If it's a very uncommon thing, so then you have to worry.
So fish blood is not prohibited?
No.
Okay, I was.
No, you don't have to shuck the fish.
So. Right.
That's why you don't have to salt
them,
the fish. You just catch a fish, cut it up.
I'm salty already.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good point. I like that.
Before, that's only for Ashkenazi.
Blood of wild animal. Right.
As milk of a wild animal?
No, blood of the wild
animal. Right, I mean, milk of a wild animal is permitted with meat.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Right.
I don't think so. Although there are certain fats in an animal that may be permitted in a wild animal that are not permitted in a. I'm not positive.
Right, but then how do you define wild animal?
Yeah.
You mean if you've domesticated them? Like a deer was a wild animal.
Right.
I mean, but if you domesticate it now, is it considered a domesticated animal? And I think a behema, that's an interesting question, that what we categorize as a chaya wild animal, has ever become a behema? I don't know.
I thought it was by category, I understood, like, you know, moose were combined.
Buffalo, right.
Even if it's a second generation, it's still a moose, it's a wild animal.
And that's what I think. Yeah. I think that's true. Dasfar Bazat, Kevin de Kainhu Aminig Bahrain Basfarad. So he also quotes that the Sephardim had these big parties and they would have almond milk with their meat. And he says, you know, in that world, that's what they did. In Kain Kulam Yodim, everybody knows that at a big meal in a Sephardi community, they make this dish out of almond milk and meat. And it's not a problem of Marisayan. And that's what they used to do in Constantinople. We may have kind of what he calls Constantina. I assume that's Constantinople. He says also they serve, you know, weddings, they'll serve you a baked potato with mayonnaise. And it looks like cream or something. I guess it looks like something milchic. In tapuche adama, v'nosnim asal l'shulchan yachid mabasa. They put it on the table with meat. Gam nosnim ugos, and there's even cookies that have, you know, like white covering from an egg. V'nirak kamo shamnunis. It looks like cream balaz. V'gam karim asal shem shamnunis. They even call it cream, a cream cake, a cream donut, whatever it is.
Cream pie.
And it's parav. And he says, you don't have to worry about Marisayan. Atamafianal. The reason is because it's before. In other words, you have to think about what will people think. It has to be logical. How do you decide what people will think? Most people. What will most people think? That's the question.
Well, it depends if it's a novelty. If it's still a novelty or if it's commonly accepted. So when parav ice cream was first invented and no one had ever heard of it before, there'd be an argument that you have to be careful with Marisayan, or at the very least, put the label on.
That's right.
When parav ice cream becomes more common, then at least among observant Jews, what you said with someone who's less observant, among observant Jews, there's an assumption that there's certain awareness.
Absolutely.
So the Subway is interesting because consider
that's like kind of a middle case.
Right. Do you consider this whole kosher Subway thing still a novelty? I do. I've never been to a kosher Subway.
Right, let's say you leave.
The rabbi who's against it isn't really against it. He's secretly against it, so that they'll put it in the newspaper, the Kol Habira, whatever it is, and then everybody will have this big controversy on Facebook, and then it'll be largely publicized, and it won't be a novelty anymore.
So it's
an interesting question. How many kosher Subways do you need, or how many people need to know that there is a kosher Subway, or you know?
I don't know.
It's a hard question. I mean, what?
The JCC had a kosher Subway.
Right, and that one
here?
Had cheese at.
In D.C.?
The one in Rockville.
Oh, wow.
But it doesn't.
That one had the fake cheese.
It did have fake cheese?
Not the ball,
And now it's bankrupt. There you have it.
Well, on the ball, one shut down.
Just joking.
Yeah, I was at one once somewhere. I do remember.
There was one.
How does it work with the Dunkin' Donuts?
Because some of them are kosher and some aren't? Right?
No, aren't. Isn't there a thing where they're allowed to serve? Some hours will allow you to serve the non-kosher stuff if it comes out of one oven, one area.
Really? There's kosher Dunkin' Donuts that serve non-kosher things?
Isn't that
I find that hard to believe.
No, the Baltimore one does not. I thought...
No, not here.
I thought there were two in Baltimore.
That seems...
There are a lot of... They don't need...
That seems very strange.
Was that one...
No, there's one thing where one person owned two different ones, and because he owned one that served non-kosher food, his other one wasn't kosher either.
Oh,
But I don't think anybody would give a shkach on a Dunkin' Donuts where only half the food was kosher.
That's why
you'd really be asking for a lot of mistakes.
That'd
be very strange.
Constantine
is in Romania.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Got it. Oh, that makes sense.
Because he's in Slovakia, I guess.
So, now there is also an opinion. There's an interesting argument between the Pre-Kaddish and others about whether do we declare things to be Marisayan that were not declared to be Marisayan by the Gemara. There is an opinion that only those things that the Gemara said are Marisayan, like drinking the blood of a fish, is Marisayan, and we don't make new rules about Marisayan, which is interesting. It seems counterintuitive.
It does or it doesn't. Or if you go by that, then you're the kind of people who don't eat turkey because you don't know it's kosher. Because then the Gemara wasn't made clear that turkey was one of the kosher foods, and it wasn't just wild, right? So you can't have it both ways.
That's interesting. I don't know.
There's people who hold like that they don't eat turkey because wasn't declared kosher in the Gemara, not a joke.
That's true.
So, okay,
absolutely.
So the same people who are like, if it's not declared kosher,
well, it has to do with there not being, not being a tradition for it. Yeah. By the way, the question also comes up, The question also, I once had this problem. One of my kids was little. Yeah, we had a bottle of mother's milk. And we were in a meat restaurant in Chicago. And I was feeding my kid this bottle. And it was breast milk. And the mashgiach came over. He's like, get out of here. What are you doing with that bottle of milk in this Chinese restaurant? I said to him, it's breast milk. It's parv. Like, I don't care. Get the heck out. Or put it away. You know, like, he just would not even hear of it. You know, so I don't know if he either added. So, you know, it's that, I guess, would be marasayin. But it does come up in halacha. Is that marasayin or not? Is that, you know, because it looks like real milk, but it's actually parv. But it's the same kind of issue. The I want to look at this Igros Moshe. Moshe Feinstein wrote a tshuva about eating in restaurants. It's on page 3. On the bottom, he says, "If a davar mutar lechol b'restaurant, restaurants." It's on the bottom of page 3. So he translates it a little bit on the bottom there, where it says, "Rav Moshe Feinstein." He kind of gives you a summary of it, but I'll just read this paragraph. Are you allowed to eat in the restaurants? She machinim sham rak ma'achalei chalav, that only make dairy. Avahim shalom anashim ma'achalei Shabbos, but they're owned by Jews who violate Shabbos. There could be forbidden things there. Just because it's dairy doesn't mean it's kosher. It could be non-kosher fish there. It could be that the oil is not kosher. It has maybe animal fat. And also the cheese might not be kosher. There's also a problem of a non-Jew cooking. So what about going in there to eat something that's kosher? Let's say you decide that you could eat the fruit plate or a salad. Can you go in there to eat that? So Rav Moshe says, Yesh la'asar mipnei marasayin v'chashad. He says we should forbid it because of marasayin.
What's chashad?
Chashad is similar to marasayin. Chashad worry? Means suspicion.
Okay. Oh, suspicion.
So it's an interesting halachic question. Is there a difference between marasayin and chashad? There might be. Achim hu rav biyoter, he says, but if you're very hungry, shemetztar tuva, you're in a lot of pain. Now remember, we're talking about eating something that you've determined is kosher. He's not saying eating in a milk restaurant is okay. He's saying if you're going to eat something in there that you've determined is really kosher, but you're essentially in a restaurant that serves non-kosher things.
Like a Starbucks? Is that like there's like all the baked
so
stuff?
So that would be an interesting question. Starbucks or what about... Now, Starbucks, I think, is a little different, let's say, than... No, let's say... I mean, I think Moshe here is basically talking about a non-kosher restaurant.
He's talking... Yeah, he seems to be talking about a non-kosher dairy restaurant owned by non-observant Jews.
Right, that's essentially what he's talking about. Yeah, so I don't think it's any different than a non-kosher restaurant.
Which Starbucks... fits the profile, except for in Starbucks, you can't eat anything. There is nothing in there that's, I mean, except for banana.
But they sell ham sandwiches.
Well, there's Hexer,
like. Yeah, right, that's what I was about to say. The only thing I can eat in there is the things that are already sealed. So they came from somewhere else. Not like
well, what about coffee?
Coffee, yes, why not?
So, well, that would be the question. If you're drinking coffee in a Starbucks, might people think you're eating the ham sandwich?
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that would be the question. I mean, that's one question, Starbucks. Another question might be, what about a completely non-kosher restaurant? Like, I don't know.
Like a pizzeria.
Lincoln, right next to my job, which I have to go to for
work
events.
So let's say you want to go in there and get something that,
kale
you know,
salad.
You want to get something to drink.
No cheese.
So kale, I'm not sure. That'd be an interesting question.
Bugs.
So we have to think about that. But,
what are you doing? They make you go
for
a work thing.
Well, so that's what we're learning about. We'll figure that out. We're going to talk about that. He says, if you got no other place to eat, so then you could go in there and eat things that you know are permitted. You have to be like in a part of the restaurant where they won't see you. And the rabbis didn't make a decree of marasayin in a situation of pain, a great need. But you have to like make sure you're not in a place where people are going to see you. Because the people inside you don't have to worry about, because they'll see you're eating a fruit plate. The problem is you have to worry about people. So I sometimes think about this, right? Like, I mean, I mentioned in a previous class, somebody got anxious about it apparently, but I mentioned that if you knew that everything in your smoothie was kosher, there really isn't a problem to get a smoothie in, what's the place on the corner here? La Pancatorian.
Right.
I don't know, they happen to have, some of their smoothies, I don't know what's in it, so I don't eat them, but they happen to have one that's it's just vegetables, so it was very clear to me that it was good. So, but then I thought, should I eat it in the window or not? if I eat in the window, everybody sees I'm just drinking something. You know, yeah, they'll assume
well,
it's something permitted.
Well, the Gemara says not to eat in the window anyway, because disgraceful, all the more so for a rabbi.
Well, it's inside.
That's right.
Inside.
So, but inside, not
in this
window.
Inside. No, this inside. So the question. So the question in my mind was: first of all, maybe I don't have to worry at all because everybody will assume that I'm getting coffee or a permitted smoothie. So one question would be, what do people do today, right? Now, that's one question is, what do most people do today? What do most people assume, right? In Starbucks, the truth is that I would go into Starbucks and drink coffee. Why? Because the nature of Starbucks is that a lot of people go in just to get coffee, and a lot of observant Jews go in just to get coffee.
It's a coffee shop.
Right. Now, it's true that Star-K has like a problem with the coffee there. I mean, not Star-K, the CRC had a problem with the coffee, and Star-K permits the coffee. So clearly, there's lots of room to allow the coffee, those cold things, the
frappuccinos
are now okay, according to the Star-K. Star-K, I think, permits all the frappuccinos, no? I think so.
No one's concerned about the equipment.
But if you go to the kosher store,
so the Star-K has a whole explanation. Star-K even distinguishes between whether you're traveling or not.
Yeah.
If you're traveling, more stuff's permitted.
Yeah, if you're like,
which is interesting because it's considered like, well, it's similar. It's considered like shasad chak. So you don't have to worry as much about the kalim over there.
Right. So that's my only concern would be like at this point.
Has to do with how the dishwashers work.
And also, like, the place that you're describing getting the smoothie, I'd be concerned about the kalim, primarily.
Right, but you could imagine there being a difference with something... Right, you couldn't get something hot there. But you could imagine there being a difference between a Starbucks, even though Starbucks sells bacon, in which, just because you're in a Starbucks, like, lots of people go into Starbucks and just drink coffee.
Right.
But that might be different than a regular restaurant somewhere, you know,
right.
The Olive Garden
example.
That you went in to get a fruit plate or whatever.
That fancy hotel is right there by the White House. There's, like, the W Hotel. And then right next to it, there's a restaurant that has, like, outdoor seating. It's very beautiful and lovely.
It's in the
W. So the question is, could you go there and get coffee?
I saw someone who I know grew up yeshiva style, is very observant, sitting at a table. And then the minute I saw him, I literally almost fainted. I went, and then the next thing I thought was, he has to be there for work because there's no other way to meet the person. And I kept walking. Like, that was what I told myself, because it's true for me.
Oh,
it's been true for
so
me.
So that's really the question I want to get at, is can you go into a restaurant for work and eat something permitted? In other words, and what's that question going to depend on? So that's going to depend on, is that like par of ice cream today or not? You know, is that something people do? Because what's the assumption on people's part? Is the assumption on people's part, oh, that guy doesn't keep kosher?
No.
Or is the assumption on people's part...
Stuck.
Like everybody, you know, if 51% of the Jewish world goes to business lunches and eats a fruit plate, so then it's probably permitted.
From our side,
right? From our side. I'm just talking about our side. Or I'm assuming you're eating something that's permitted, obviously. so that would be an interesting question. As I think today may be different than 10 years ago. I also think Washington and New York might be different than Peoria.
We get ahead of it.
Well, because I bet, you know, I bet half the people in the shul are lawyers who go to meals, and it's probably very normal, I'm guessing, I think. So we'll see. There is some discussion on this.
So you're saying somewhere like New York where there's other options of, like, that are kosher business restaurants?
Oh, I was thinking that in New York it's less of an issue because there's so many Jews in business.
Most Jews will go to
a,
you mean you could take
go to the fancy restaurants, the business, you know, so Wolf and Lamb, and sit down and have a business.
You mean
so
even if the boss is taking you out,
yeah, if you
have
one
you
Jewish
restaurant.
Person who maybe is observant, but you're going to the non-kosher fancy restaurant, then like that's a little bit weirder than Wolf and Lamb, where everyone goes to, and that's normal.
But a lot of fancy restaurants in New York, if you call in advance, will get you a kosher meal. If it's a non-kosher place, whereas basically almost any other city won't do that for you.
Right? I actually just had, I have this week. There's a lawyer in the show who invited me to, he does like an award ceremony for lawyers, I don't know, and it's at a hotel. And
the hotels don't play. They will get you a kosher meal. It's double wrapped, triple wrapped. It's
that's
amazing.
What I'm hoping.
And it's delicious.
I'm hoping that
it's
he didn't
so
go all the way
good.
Out of his way, and it's going to come to
and
me, and I'm going to be like, oh, I can't eat that.
It's super delicious, and
I'm
it's
sure
super double wrapped. It's very serious,
I hope so.
And they bring
hope
it from
so.
Rockville or Silver Spring or somewhere awesome,
that's what I'm
Baltimore.
Hoping.
Yeah. It's very good.
That's
trust
good.
Me,
so,
question.
The only thing you have to tell the server, I'm sorry, but you do have to tell the server, please don't take the plastic off. By accident, just like in the airplanes, they think they're being helpful, and you just have to remind them. They say, oh, I already know.
Now, obviously, when they bring it to my plate, it's going to be all wrapped. That's going to be obvious, right? But what happens
no,
after half
obvious.
An hour?
It's It's not obvious to them.
After half an hour, it may be on a... And sometimes they send these on real plates with real forks and knives, right? From Shulam's or whatever.
Well, usually they put
So do I have to worry that somebody talking to me at this dinner...
No,
today is it very common that, you know, hotels have kosher food?
But it will be obvious that you're having some food brought in. You know,
right,
at least
right.
Everyone,
right.
What you're eating is
right.
kosher food that's brought in.
Rabbi, exactly.
You mean because the food will actually look different. It's not going to be exactly
the
same.
Food
or maybe
probably,
you need
yeah.
to keep some of the plastic wrapping or something.
It's like this.
Oh, so that's interesting. Usually I end up with these bowls
exactly.
of plastic wrap. Right.
Number one, the plastic plates, they don't put it on a real plate in any of these. And I go to this
really?
Stuff all the time.
Uh-huh.
They don't put it on a real plate, but they do put it on the fancy plastic plates. So it's got a charge or whatever, but it's still a plastic plate at the end of the day. So it's distinguishable. The second thing is what you all noted is that you have all this trash left over, because the only concern, I'd say the only time I've ever had a problem is that by accident, trying to be nice, they want to take the plastic off before they bring it to me, and then I'm left without
it. Right, no, that's a problem.
So
that's a problem.
If you can intercept them, you're
yeah,
good.
Yeah, no, I will. So Rav Moshe felt it's a real problem. There were others who did not feel it was such a problem. Either because we don't make new gezeiras of something being marasayan, or because we live in a time when this is like par of ice cream. Let's see. This is interesting. There's a... Okay. So I do think, on a practical level, I do think there's room. I think in a place like Washington, I think it's very, very common that Jews go to, you know, meals with okay, so I want to touch very briefly on the other issues, right? The other issues are bishalakum, cooking by a non-Jew. What's a problem? Let's say you have something that's kosher, being cooked in a kosher pot, being cooked by a non-Jew. So there was a gezeira, a decree, not to eat things cooked by a non-Jew. Similar to eating their bread and maybe their wine, that you might end up marrying them. So, but that gezeira was only made with regard to things that are not subject to two conditions. One is nechochai, if it could be eaten raw, it was not subject to the problem of being cooked by a non-Jew. So if a non-Jew cooks carrots or cooks something that can be eaten raw, that's not considered bishalakum. Becomes an interesting question today. What about fish? Can fish be eaten raw?
Sushi.
Is fish eaten raw, right? So I think it's different than it was 20 years ago. 20
right.
years ago, I think it was bishalakum eating fish cooked by a non-Jew, obviously in a kosher pot, but everything being done by the non-Jew. But I think today it's probably much less of a problem. I think sushi has permitted. I think sushi has changed perhaps the rule of bishalakum.
When you say cooking, I mean the non-Jew is lighting the
exactly.
flame.
Right. Now, if a Jew lights the flame,
right,
that's considered bishal
yeah.
yisrael. Right. Okay. Again, this is because the gezeir is not going to be kosher. Because the gezeir, we're assuming everything's kosher. It's the gezeir derabanan of eating food by a non-Jew.
Well, what about going to a sushi restaurant and eating sashimi, which is just the fish without?
Okay, so let's talk about that question, right? Because that does come up. So, what are the potential issues, right? So, cooking's not an issue.
Right,
cooking
so
in a non-kosher pot.
Fish.
Well, cooking the rice is an issue.
Right. Well, sashimi is just the fish without rice, without anything else. It's
just the
raw fish.
Okay, so
and the rice isn't a problem here. Is why? Because there's where to hold that it's just it's rehydrating the rice. I've read this. I can't remember. I don't have a source for this, but that's horrible. I know.
Talking about pre-cooked rice.
Pre-cooked rice.
But pre-cooked rice could be different.
It's only like rehydrating.
But I don't think sushi restaurants
use pre-cooked
rice. At the
end of the day, what Japanese person is going to put some non-rice item in the rice cooker? Their master rice cooker.
The rice isn't cooked
when
you do it. In a sushi restaurant, they're cooking the rice there. It's not pre-hydrated. It's not pre-cooked rice already, right?
In either case, the point
I mean,
is
it's
that
true. If you had parboiled rice,
cross-contamination.
Then minute rice, that might be...
They're not
going to
have cross-contamination
okay.
with other things that are trafe, right? I don't know.
No, I don't think you have to worry about the rice. I think rice is probably cooked in a rice cooker. The question is rice subject to this or bishalakum? The other thing about bishalakum is not just if it could be eaten raw, but is it ola al shulchan malachim? Is it something that could be put on a king's table?
Oh, yeah.
Why does that happen?
Well, because the issue wasn't sort of eating a snack with a non-Jew. We weren't worried you would get too chummy then. The issue was having a party with them. Having a formal, you know, and there's a social interaction was around a formal meal. That's the issue.
So the Mikado's table, they would have had rice.
The what?
The Japanese emperor's table.
Sure. Right.
Is this
so rice
or?
In general is considered an issue.
All right. So these are these either or?
Yeah, it could be either.
Okay.
Doesn't have to be both. So there is one opinion, it's a minority opinion, that there aren't so many things that are subject to Bishul Akum because they have to be really fancy things. In general, we don't hold that way. In general, we're worried about Bishul Akum as long as... And it's hard for us actually to figure out what's called goes on the king's table. There are certain things in Halacha that have been said to be not subject to that. I think the Aruch Shulchan said potatoes.
And tuna, yes.
Tuna?
They even said tuna. There was a like I don't know tuna? If the Shulchan Aruch says it, but tuna like, yeah, like tuna of a can. Because not...
Oh, in a can. Oh, right. Yeah. Canned things are considered, in general, not Olal right. Shulchan Malachim. If something's very pedestrian, it would probably not be considered. So it becomes a hard question, what's considered what. But well, so let's say the raw fish question. Could you eat raw fish? So the only issue, I think, is two issues, right? One is the knife. Is the knife clean? You can probably assume the knife is clean, I think. They're probably very careful about that.
They usually do it in front of you. So.
Right, right. So you know, if it's not spicy, all you have to worry about is there fat from non-kosher fish on the knife? Again, I think they're probably on their own clean it off because they're worried about that. The only issue is how do you know it's kosher fish? That would be the issue. So there's certain kinds of fish that they allow you to assume some of the kosher organizations. Salmon is basically the one because it looks like reddish fish apparently all kosher. In halacha, it used to be that only you had to be able to see the scales.
Yeah,
so if you saw him cut the... Red. Yeah, I don't know. People don't seem to monitor tuna that way. Maybe
cooked tuna turns white. Maybe it's, or it's white tuna. I'm not sure.
Yes,
exactly.
I don't. I've heard it only about salmon. If you saw the guy cut the fish, you know, if you saw the guy cut the scales off.
They have like a completely filleted right. without scales
That's
without
true.
Anything.
But so. If you saw them cut the scales off, or if it was salmon, in theory, a piece of raw fish should be fine. Do you have to worry about nori? It's an interesting question. Let's say you knew the nori was kosher. Do you have to worry that there's... Right, do you have to worry about worms in the nori? So those are interesting questions, and rice would be interesting questions. Obviously, there are better things and worse things in the realm of this.
So basically, the only thing really that you'd kind of feel safe about would probably be salmon sashimi.
That would be, that or you
no
could,
rice,
right.
No
I mean, I could imagine a fruit salad. I could imagine a regular salad. Might be certain kinds of vegetables that could be problematic. Obviously, dressings
like
could be
lettuces,
an issue, but if you just had olive oil, that would be fine.
Lettuces.
Certain kinds of lettuce are probably okay, like iceberg lettuce. Mm-hmm. You know, if it was like from a package, like those sort of packaged triple washed lettuces.
Can
you know,
just triple wash?
So I tell people that they could use bagged triple washed lettuce, but they should check some of the leaves from different parts of the bag, make sure there's no infestation. If there's no infestation, I don't think you have to check every leaf because I've never seen a bug in it. It's washed very well.
So wait a minute. So
you don't have to. You only have to worry. You know, if it's like less than a certain percentage, you don't have to worry.
Right. So if triple washed can get like a pass, sort of. Why would the nori be a problem? Nori gets crushed, so much more like strawberry jam, where if a bug was on a strawberry,
yeah.
it'd be a problem. But
so
if
that
crushed
could be.
Jam, it's not
could
a problem.
Be. I have no
it's
idea.
Sand.
Right, that could be. Could be. I don't know. I don't know the science
how
of nori.
How would you hide a bug?
Right, so if it's true, that the bugs would all be crushed in the nori, and they're less than a 60th of the nori, that could, in theory, be permitted. Rice.
Yeah, but if you went by that opinion, then all. Nori could have hashgacha, and not all of them do.
No, but laundry detergent has hashgacha.
Yeah, but that doesn't,
prove anything.
It's not just a function
water
of
has hashgacha.
They have to pay for it and be willing.
So I just want to touch on one other thing. There's an interesting question about coffee and tea. Can you drink coffee out of a cup?
This is for Bishul Akum too.
Oh, so that's one question. Is Bishul Akum an issue with coffee and tea? So in general, obviously, since lots of people eat out in coffee shops, even you know people who think about these things, there is a lot of discussion of it in halacha, but in general, we don't consider coffee and tea to be a problem with Bishul Akum because either it's just water, really. In halacha, it could be that coffee and tea is really considered water. With flavoring.
Right. That it's just brought back to life. It's just like reconstituted or remoistened. Like
it's really water with flavoring. That's one possibility. Or that maybe it's not considered, coffee and tea maybe is not considered sort of important enough. That's one possibility also.
Oh, like coffee and tea being like a spice almost, if they're flavoring the water.
That's sort of the idea.
Well, you have to make sure the tea is cooked.
Yeah.
Actually, a kosher tea bag before you.
Well, right, you have to know the ingredients are kosher. Yeah. But plain tea doesn't need ashgacha.
Yeah,
you know,
it doesn't carry. Plain tea, with if it doesn't have added flavors or anything, it's kosher.
Yeah.
You don't need to have a hechsher for something.
Right, that's true.
He's saying the flavor.
Okay.
Right. So the question becomes, though, what if you're on an airplane or you're in a restaurant and they serve it to you in a regular cup? Can you drink that? So so it's better, obviously, not to, I think. But there are heterim for that. And the question becomes, number one, do you have to worry that within 24 hours they put something non-kosher? Do you have to worry that they put the non-kosher thing in halacha that they worry about in coffee cups is milk? But the truth is that in America, we, unless you're Machmir Chav Yisrael, we consider all our milk to be kosher. So really, the only problem with a coffee cup kind of comes down to how it's washed in the dishwasher. And that perhaps we worry about less because of the soap. So I think it's better to use a paper cup. I think if they serve it to you in a regular cup, or you know, you're on an airplane, all they have is regular cups, that should be permitted.
Are there additives put in coffee and tea that are not kosher?
Only flavored coffee and flavored tea.
Okay, so would we be considering it gets hot, so therefore it absorbs and transmits? Would be if someone gave me a cup of coffee, would we be concerned then the last 24 hours they had flavored coffee in that cup?
That's a good question. So in general, we assume that vessels have not been used in the last 24 hours, but some people write that maybe it's different in a restaurant because maybe they're constantly using them. So then the question is, does the dishwasher count for much? So some people say that there's sort of two things. In other words, it's sveksveka. I can't remember who writes this, but in one of the tshuvas, they write that it's sveksveka. Two doubts, which might make it permitted. One doubt is maybe it wasn't used within the last 24 hours. So the question is, in a restaurant, is that a doubt? And if it was used within the last 24 hours, maybe it's used with something kosher. Because most of what they put in the coffee cup is kosher. You wouldn't assume that necessarily about a plate that's usually used to serve bacon, but a coffee cup, a lot of what's is kosher. So some have printed it for that reason. I think paper is certainly better.
They're not concerned with the fact that it's put into a dishwasher with the dishes and plates
right.
and everything else.
That's a good question. I mean, yeah. Because, the Starbucks, even in Starbucks, what they make the coffee in could be an issue. So it depends. There are some that feel that since there's always soap in the dishwasher, that renders it like a bad taste. It sort of erases the taste of everything. It sometimes depends how the... I think what the Star-K does is distinguish between if you're on the road or not. The CRC had had a... Their issue had been like the way that the dishwashers function, I think. They had thought that there was like... It was like hotter before there was soap or something. Like there was a run with the dishwasher that just used hot water without soap. That sort of made it a bigger problem. But I did find this short essay it's a longer essay, but I took some parts of it, by Dayan, a rabbinical judge at a rabbinical Beis Din and Kiryat Matzesdorf, who wrote something about eating in a non-kosher kitchen. And he has some interesting stuff about fruits, vegetables, treif, knives, food preparation by a Gentile. And that's like on the last page. It's interesting. He says, he's getting this from Rav Moshe. If none of the food served is kosher, you may only be seated there if there are no Jews around to see you. Or you are not recognizable as Jewish. That seems like kind of a slippery slope. Although you couldn't eat there, you might want to enter for a meeting and just drink some water. So you can see clearly that he permits you to go into a non-kosher restaurant. He also says you could purchase a kosher fish even if it was cut with a treif knife. Many people hold that.
The thing is, like, with kosher fish, there's some opinions that you, like, can scrape off the layer where the knife was.
Yeah, you could do that. I mean, the truth is that most of the kosher organizations allow people to buy
fish
at, you know, Safeway.
And slice your own
and you don't have to worry about the knife.
So, when the rabbis who certify, you know, vegan restaurants, what are they kind of concerned about, and what kind of things they allow? And how do that things
so, the main issues of vegan, we're working on one now. We are working on one. We're having a real conversation about one that has three branches in D.C. See if it works out. But so the main two issues in a vegan restaurant are bishul akum, food being cooked by a non-Jew. There are ways to get around that. You know, if it's right. a stove that has a pilot light, for instance, the pilot was lit by a Jew, that might permit everything. So now they're starting to use these like heating bulbs that stay on all the time and are adding heat to the thing. There's like these bulbs, apparently, that some of the kosher organizations use that create a lot of heat. I guess they stay on all the time, and they contribute a significant amount of heat to the fryer or whatever, and I don't know. I'm not exactly sure how that works. But the main problem is bishul akum and bugs. Those are the two main problems with vegetarian or vegan restaurants. With vegetarian restaurants, it could be cheese. Like,
yeah. And
right. Vinegar. I don't think eggs are such an issue.
Well, also, you have less eggs.
I don't think we worry about that as much because our eggs are not fertilized. I think once it's already mixed in,
vegan doesn't have to worry about it.
They're very few.
They serve hard boiled. Like if they do it, they serve.
There is a vegan falafel place in D.C.
It's not vegan.
What?
They have one.
So, because you have.
Do when we're off the recording, and I want to hear because we're working on it.
There's a section. No, because there's a section here on vegetarian restaurants, which is different than vegan, obviously.
Right. So vegetarian restaurants.
You talk about the margarine, number six.
Right. Right. So in other words, he's basically saying you have to worry about things in vegetarian restaurants: wine, margarine, cheese. I mean, cheese would depend on the other class question.
Right.
Bishul akum, bugs. I mean, these are all issues.
So, how do you get around the light in a restaurant like this, or turning the stove on?
Oh, the lighting.
Yeah. What's kind of the way around?
So, the restaurant's I actually just emailed Avad in another city to see how they deal with. So it's interesting. Now, what they're starting to use is like electric pots. What do they call those? Induction.
Warmers.
Induction pots.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of places are starting to use those.
Induction.
You said induction.
Induction, right. That's where it's done by magnets. So it's an interesting question. There's a threefold question. I mean, one question is that considered cooking? There's no heat. I mean, there is heat, obviously, but there's no fire. It's an interesting question. Is that halachically a bishul akum issue? Yeah. Like, is microwaving a bishul akum issue? Is that called bishul? So it's not.
So if you're cooking raw vegetables in a microwave, you know, you're steaming them in a microwave. That would not necessarily be bishul, you're saying? Because of the process.
Well, let's say a non-Jew cooked something that is subject to bishul akum.
Right.
A piece of meat, and they cooked it in a microwave. Is that called bishul? It's true, it cooked it. But is that part of the gezeira of bishul akum, or is that, you know, Chazal obviously only knew cooking with fire. Is that called cooking in halacha? I guess it would have other repercussions. Like, let's say you took meat and milk and... So you took cow's milk and cow's meat and you put it in a bowl together and put it in the microwave. Is that considered cooking? So it's very... Well, I don't know. If it's not considered cooking, it's not fossil fuel either, right? And it's permitted.
The microwave...
It's just Mara Zion.
The device is...
Well, we don't eat them together.
Right? We can't eat it.
Yeah, you're right.
The question is
that an Isser Bishul?
It's an
interesting question. I think many do consider that cooking, but... I mean, I guess it could come up about Shabbos also. What if you cooked food on Shabbos in a microwave? What if, you know, obviously it's got other problems, but let's say that somebody non-observant cooked food for you in the microwave on Shabbos, you're allowed to eat that. Is that considered cooked on Shabbos? It is cooked. It's made it.
Or you set it on
thin.
A timer.
Because what's called cooking is an interesting question. Well, we set it on a timer.
If the issue we're saying is just that it's not cooking, then there would be no problem with setting it on a timer. Just so you
but the
land,
flame
just
still goes on.
Even if it is cooking, maybe you could put it on a timer.
But is a microwave?
Can you put coffee on a timer?
Right, there's a lot of other issues, as the rabbi said.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I'm just trying to ask, I'm asking a very specific question. Don't mistake me for saying that you can microwave something not kosher, that you could use a microwave in Shabbos. I didn't say any of that. I'm just asking an interesting question. What was the question? Oh, about bishul akum.
Yes, really bishul akum.
How to solve the problem of bishul akum?
Yeah,
So it's interesting. I once found a tshuva of the Rivos Ephraim, Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, Zal. And he said an interesting thing. He said that, this came up actually about tuna also. And a tuna is cooked sometimes on the boats. Now, maybe that's a problem, that tuna was cooked. Because when it's cooked, it's a tuna. It's not in a can yet. So is that a problem? Is non-Jews on the boats cooking the tuna? So I didn't see this in writing, but I think that Rav Moshe said that was okay. Because like, you don't have to worry about And it's more like bakery bread. You don't have to worry. You don't even know the guy on the boat. Mm. And he's on a boat out in the middle of the Atlantic cooking your tuna. You don't have to worry about marrying him. You know, like, it's not even, that's not even the gazera, basically. So that becomes an interesting question. Do you, so he said interesting thing. He said, what about factory? Let's say this food being cooked in a factory. So in general, the mashgiach does turn it on or press a button or something, so it's not bishalakum. But is it really a problem in a factory? And if you have a factory cooking, is that, maybe that's more like, maybe that doesn't have the problem of the gazera.
The bigger problem is that none of that's toiled.
It's owned by a non-Jew.
But they're owned by,
if it's owned by a non-Jew, it's not a problem. Hey, you could even buy a vessel, and you know, if you don't acquire it,
Tovah's on the individual.
Somebody's owned by a non-Jew, yeah. You know,
the person's eating there, I think, right?
Yeah,
Tovah's on the
individual.
The owner, not on the individual. Is like, you can, if you,
it's not on the plate, it's on the person.
Probably, is that? That's probably true. Yeah, you mean, can you, if you're in somebody's house and you worry that they didn't Tovah, it could eat in their house.
Right, it's not.
Yes, in general, it doesn't make food not kosher.
So what is that?
Some people does. Oh, so I said, so it was actually a vegetarian restaurant. It was in St. Louis, vegetarian restaurant, and they cooked the food in this restaurant part and served it somewhere else. And Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt writes, he says, if the pots they use are like pots you would never have in a house, like factory pots, so he thinks that's not a problem. If they don't serve it in there, so it's basically cooking it in a factory. And it's a type of pot that you wouldn't use in the house. So that's not called, that wasn't part of the gzera of eating with eating a non-Jew's food.
What if it's like a takeout place, for example?
But it turns out, like, the national kosher organizations don't hold on that. And so it didn't work at that restaurant. So you have to figure out in a restaurant how to deal with the bishlakum issue. So usually it's done through pilot lights and things like that, or... There, I once heard about a mashgiach had a way through his phone to turn on the fire or something.
Like that.
It's an app now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that might, so that's an interesting question. Is that considered cooking? It's a funny thing because, you know, it's like we've sort of...
It's like supervision by...
I mean, it's the way halacha works, but we've made the gzera into something like here, you know, whereas it really wasn't meant here. It was... something, it was really a very different thing.
You're not supposed to leave on, I think what you were saying about the vegetarian, either another issue would be the, like, leaving the hard-boiled eggs unpeeled overnight. And
so that's a separate problem.